Good morning. Morning, gentlemen. Welcome to The Hub, Fall 2019. We're glad you are here. The Hub meets every Tuesday morning here, right around 7. And for this, we don't normally do, occasionally we'll bring in an outside speaker. And this morning we're honored to have Larry Nelson with us. He and Mike will be coming up here in a few minutes. But Larry, talking with Larry this morning, discovered that Larry, you and I actually have a good number of things in common. We're both from Marietta. We both love the game of golf. Larry, you're listed in Who's Who among Hall of Fame athletes. I'm listed in Who's He. But we are thrilled that you guys are joining us this morning, and I want to tell you a little bit about the Hub before Larry comes up. The Hub meets here again. We get together about 6:45 for breakfast. Sometimes we'll have Chick-fil-A. Sometimes we'll have bagels. If Steve, our primary teacher, was really good the week before, we'll get everything bagels. That's his preference. But we'll always start right at the top of the hour, right at 7 o'clock in the morning. And what if you've not been to the Hub before, the first half hour or so is spent in teaching. Steve will unpack God's word for us as we're sitting around tables. And then the second half of the hour is spent in discussion, guys around the table. And I'm really looking forward to this year because this year we're going to be going through the book of Philippians. Philippians is such a powerful book. And I picture us as we go into, say, Philippians chapter 2, where we're talking about humility, talking about what does it look like to live out the humility of Christ. Now, some of you might be there saying, I don't need that. I don't need any help with humility. I got humility down real good. And if that's your case, you may not want to join us. But for the rest of us, as we're going through the book of Philippians and we're talking about what does it look like to live this out? Because the cool thing about the Hub, we talk about coming here to be equipped, encouraged, and empowered. We're equipped by God's word, we're encouraged by God's men, and we're empowered by God's spirit. And that's a really good recipe for life change. That's why we're here every Tuesday morning. So we hope you'll join us. You'll hear a little bit more details as we wrap up this morning. But I want to introduce Larry. You probably know a good bit about Larry Nelson. Larry is a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame. He has won dozens of professional tournaments on the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour around the world, including 3 major championships. Larry also, his reputation on the tour is stellar. He's known as a class act, and I think that he would probably say, even though many people would say Larry Nelson is an amazing ambassador for the game of golf, I think you'll hear, as you hear from his heart, I think what's more important to him is that he is an ambassador for his faith. So let me introduce and bring up Larry Nelson and Mike Slaughter.
Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate that.
Welcome, brother.
Thank you. I've got to tell you one story before we get started. At the church one year, a bunch of deacons got together and says, We need to find out who the most humblest person in church is. And he says, we're going to give him a pen. And so they thought about it and said, yep, John's the most humble guy in the church. So they presented him with a pen. Next week, they had to take it away because he wore it. So, yeah, humility is, you know, one of those things that, yeah, comes with a price.
Gentlemen, thank you all so much for being here today. And it's a great crowd. I am so proud of y'all, as is TJ and Zach, who worked very closely with me as we served the men of the church on Tuesday mornings. Larry Nelson is a man of faith. A story that's going to inspire you. I've had the privilege to spend a little time with Larry on the phone, just getting to know him a little bit. And one thing became very clear to me. God has a chosen lane for every guy to live out life, to live out faith. And if we make the decision to be all in our walk with Christ, he is going to use that lane for his glory. Any amens to that?
Amen.
So Larry's going to unpack that. So as far as this lane of ministry and his career, Larry, how did it come about that you, number one, had interest in the game of golf, and secondly, this, like a rocket going to the top into PGA Tour life?
Yeah, I, going through high school or growing up, I grew up in a 9 acres of land between Ackworth and Kennesaw. Matter of fact, our mailing address was Ackworth and or Kennesaw. We get mail from either place. It didn't matter. But no golf courses. I think Pine Tree was built in 1960-something, anyway. And so I was not introduced to golf at all. I had no desire to play golf. The only thing, we would see a golf match on television and when the family was sitting around. And one time they saw Arnold Palmer. Arnold Palmer was walking across the TV screen, and they says, well, you know, his birthday is September 10th. And Mom looked at me, and he says, he's got the same birthday as you. Oh, and he says, maybe you'll grow up to be a professional golfer. Yeah, okay, that's fine. So anyway, I didn't know how prophetic that was at the time, but also my younger brother has the same birthday as Yogi Berra, but he didn't grow up to be a baseball player. So. But anyway, I went through high school, played football, baseball, basketball, and actually was a good basketball and baseball player. I know my size limited me to where I could go in basketball, but I had the scoring record at North Cobb High School for 15 years after I graduated. So pretty good basketball player, baseball player. That was where I wanted to go. But after I got out of high school, I went to work for a little bit. I got the scholarship to Southern Tech, which is no longer there, to play baseball and basketball. And I had to quit one quarter to get enough money, to make enough money, so I could go on the road trips and do what some of the other kids did. But I got drafted. Got drafted into the Army. I got a 10 days after my 19th birthday, I got my draft notice. Had to report 10 days later. So 20 days after my 19th birthday, I was training to go to Vietnam, basically. Trained in Fort Hood, Texas for 18 months, and then they sent me to Vietnam. But during that 18 months of training, one of my best friends, we were sitting around, I asked him, I said, what did you enjoy doing? What was most important to you before the Army? And he says, well, I went to Miami-Dade on a golf scholarship. So it kind of interests. He was a big old guy, you know. I didn't tell him what I thought. I thought golf was a sissy sport back in, you know. But I didn't tell him what I thought about golf. So I went to Vietnam, came back, pitching in the city league in Kennesaw. I'd only been back home for a week, and I hurt my arm, so I couldn't really do what I really wanted to do, which was pitch, play baseball. So I started playing golf. And the only reason I started playing golf is because I needed something to do from 9 o'clock when my last class ended until 6 o'clock when my wife got home. And golf, as you know, can fill up a lot of space. And so I would go out there every day. Every day after my 9 o'clock class was over, I'd go to Pine Tree Country Club and play and practice and bother the pro there. You know, I just hung out there. And a little over 2 years later, because of my improvement in golf, a group of guys says, why don't you go try to play? And we'll sponsor you. You can go play, see, you know, how good you can get. Went down to Tampa for a year and qualified for the tour in 1973. Never had to qualify again, and ended up here. So what are you going to do? And there was a space of time in between that was really pretty good. I mean, I enjoyed it pretty good.
All right, so guys, a friend was talking with me this past week, and it was about you, and you playing by yourself, I assume. You were playing two balls, and you chose to, the score would be the worst of the two.
Right.
So what was with that?
Well, golf is such a great sport in that you can go out by yourself and improve. You know, a lot of cases, a lot of sports, you have to have a competitor. You have to have somebody you're either hitting it back to or whatever that to improve. But golf, you can go out and get better each day because you have to write down your score. And I figured that in choosing my worst shot and shoot under par, playing two balls, and choosing my worst score, then I was getting pretty good, right? Now, if you've never tried that, go try that sometime. See what see what your score might end up being. But so anyway, that was a kind of a way of competing against myself. I was always trying to break par for 9 holes, and then I was trying to break par for 18 holes. But I can tell you that from the first round on a regulation golf course I played, within 8 months, I'd shot under par. So I went from not playing to breaking par in less than 8 months. Some people say, oh, you were a natural. I said, no, I practiced a lot. But I had the secret. If anyone knows the secret, you can kind of ask me, and I'll tell you what the secret of that is. Secret. No,
Jim, you shouldn't ask that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So a contemporary of ours, Hill Irwin, and we talked about this on the phone.
Right.
Hill Irwin said, golf will teach you more about yourself than anything else. So if that be true, what has the game of golf taught you about yourself?
Taught me? I think there's probably, I kind of try to reverse that a little bit. I said, what has the Bible taught me about golf? Which golf teaches you a lot. Golf is a lifetime of struggle in 18 holes. I mean, honestly, for most of us. But the good thing about golf is that every day is a new day. I mean, every day. And that's what we're given every morning. We're given a new lease on life. It's new every morning, basically. And golf, you always have to look forward. Always look forward. Never look back. If you ever look back at what you should have done, then you can't concentrate on what you should be doing. And, the Bible tells us that we're always to go forward. Philippians, what you're going into, is a great book for athletes. It's a tremendous book, and for non-athletes too. But for athletes, it's a great book. I mean, we're to strive forward. We're to do our best and not look back, finish the race. And so really playing golf is the same way. And when I look at issues, and everybody who is a parent, a husband, everybody has issues. But the game of golf taught me that the issues they're important at the time, but tomorrow or the next hole, you have to forget about this and you have to go forward. And we raised our kids that way. We, every day was a new day. No matter what happened yesterday, today is a new day. So I think that's the biggest thing, that it's hard for me to separate golf from the spiritual side. And my life from the spiritual side in golf. I mean, golf, I've been playing golf since 1974, competitively, since 73. And I can tell you through all the trials and tribulations and all that kind of stuff, but let me just tell you this, that golf, yes, I've had so many people ask me a question, how do you feel over that 10-footer for, it wasn't 15 million, I can tell you, basically. But it's all relative. It was whether I ate or not, basically.
Wow.
But it's no different. It's no different than a sales meeting, or it's no different than a, presentation that you have to make, or is this going to happen? I'm doing all this work so I can make this money happen, or this thing, this sales. We all are involved in those type of things, but ours just happens to be on television. So everybody can see that. And, with our golf games, some of the average golf games, making a 10-footer for $5 kind of gets us, to where we can't draw it back.
For me, it's a 2-footer.
Two-footer? All right, that's it. But but for us, we're concentrating so hard on what we're trying to do that if you ever think about money or position or anything like that, then you're in trouble. And you actually have to deal with that. I remember walking up the, I won the PGA at the Atlanta Athletic Club. I started out with a three-day lead, a three-stroke lead, playing with Tom Kite and Fuzzy Zeller. They're my playing partners or opponents the last day. And all these thoughts come into your mind. You know, what are you going to say at the presentation? I mean, honestly, that happens to you on the third hole, you know, when you're playing. And you have to kind of say, no, I can't think about that right now. I've got to hit this ball on the green. And so you're deluged with thoughts. But let me just tell you this quick little story here. Like I said, I was leading the tournament in Atlanta, at the Atlanta Athletic Club by three shots. I had a 3 o'clock tee time on Sunday afternoon. Which is a bad thing if you've got a 2- and a 4-year-old that you've got to deal with for 8 hours before you go play, basically. But the good thing was I could go to my church. I was able to go to church to the 11 o'clock service, get through, and go out there. And so wow. I'm praying the night before, you know, I need some help, God. You know, I just, you know, just do your thing. But, you know, I've got a 3-shot lead. If I play bad and lose this, they're going to say, oh, Larry Nelson lost the PGA. But if I play good, I can win, right? So the answer to that prayer was when I went to church the next morning, most of you are familiar with the Old Rugged Cross, you know, the song, the Old Rugged Cross. Well, there's a little stanza in there that says, at last my trophies I lay down.
Wow.
Okay. And that just jumped out at me. He said, no matter how I do today, even if I win the tournament, I can't take it with me. You know, eventually, these trophies are either going to be thrown in the trash or they're going to be whatever. And so a little bit of peace there. Second song we sung that morning was Victory in Jesus. Okay. So now, now I'm going to lay down my trophies, okay. And the next one is the victory's already won. I had already had the victory through Jesus Christ. I'm talking about the eternal victory. So this victory that I'm stressed out so much about on Sunday, that day, it put it in perspective to what I'm really trying to do. So it enabled me to go out and play as good as I could play. And the results, I left up to God. And end up winning by 4, I think. So I'm just telling you that God does not only just save us for eternity, but he...
Absolutely.
It's beneficial in how we live our life.
Absolutely. So in the audience today, guys who are married, some not.
I'm really married.
Yeah, you and me both. But, you know, this thing of having a career, having ambition, having that kind of drive, and balancing life. First stop along the road, your wife, what role did she play, obviously, in marriage, encouragement, and so forth, but while all the change was coming to your life, because of the victories and the success, it was changing the landscape, I imagine, of y'all's lives. Tell us a little bit about her response to...
well, we were talking earlier, and I was telling people that I've known my wife since she was 3 years old. So we grew up together. Probably the first time I met her was at kindergarten. I mean, I don't remember exactly where I met her, but... She says she does not remember not knowing me. So we grew up together, and all through that, we celebrated our 52nd wedding anniversary this past June. So we've been together for a long time. But nobody knew her any better than I did as we were growing up. When I qualified for the tour in 1973, because of my church background, and because of our church background, we wanted to kind of go to church when we were out there. And there was just a small group of guys and wives that met actually in a hotel room. That's how small it was. and with Bible study and that kind of stuff. And so we decided we'd go. Didn't particularly like it, you know, when we went. But Billy Graham spoke at a group up in Charlotte, and we said, well, we could probably go hear Billy. And so we went to Billy Graham. He came to spoke to the Bible study. And so nothing happened, but we enjoyed it. But he says, if you ever want to know what your relationship with the Lord is, read John and Romans. And that, I didn't remember a lot about what he said, but I did remember that. And so anyway, the next year, 1975, my wife attended a tea for with some of the Christian ladies out there in the Bible study, and she prayed to receive Christ at that tea. And so she comes back and tells me, you know, I asked Jesus Christ to come into my life. And I said, why? Why? I said, you're a good person. I said, I've known you all your life. I said, why do you need Jesus? She said, well, I was convinced that I was a sinner. And she was a good person, and I was fairly good, but she was much better than me. So I, you know, I said, okay, I'll just watch her. I'll just see kind of what goes on, see what kind of change there is. Anyway, we, of course, lived together, and then that fall, I was playing up in Milwaukee, and I was trying to get into the Bible, and I'd start reading Genesis, and by the time I got to Genesis, third chapter, I was so tired. So I didn't go any further. I mean, I didn't. But I was walking across the bridge in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I said, God, you're going to have to do the same thing to me as you did to Saul. Oh, yeah, don't pray that prayer. Do not... Whatever you do, do not pray that prayer, all right? And nothing happened. I mean, I made it back across the bridge. Everything was fine. It was all right. But we played in California the next year, and we were playing up. I missed the cut at Pebble Beach, Bing Crosby. So we were driving in Palm Springs. Bob Hope was the next tournament. So we were driving down Highway 5, and... I was looking down the interstate, and there was some dust blowing across the road. And I said, yeah, but I guess, you know, it was so far away, I didn't notice anything. As we got closer, the car in front of us went into this little dust thing and disappeared. I mean, basically disappeared. Last thing I saw was the lights go on, brake lights. And so I got in there and couldn't see anywhere, couldn't see anything, and I put my brake lights on. I put my brakes on. Well, the car behind us was used to that kind of stuff, knowing that it's usually maybe 30 or 40 feet or yards deep, and then on the other side, it's fine. I didn't know that. He did. So he hit our car, totaled our car, in Button Willow, California. And I got whiplash. I couldn't raise my head off the bed. And so we drive down. Instead of going to Palm Springs because I couldn't play, we end up going to San Diego. And we had this little hotel room we rented waiting for the tournament to come to San Diego the next week. And there was a little book on the nightstand. It was on the outside. It was just love. You know, it was just, that was what it was, just love. And it was the New Testament, you know, New English, New Testament. And so I didn't have anything else to do. So remembering what Billy Graham had said the year before, I started reading John and Romans, and in reading that, I found out that, you know, all of us have sinned. All of us have sinned, no matter. And I finally realized that Gail, as good as she was, my wife, she had sinned, and she had realized that. So I realized I was a sinner. But then reading on, you know, it said that God demonstrated his love unto us, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So, in the hotel room in San Diego in 1975, I asked Christ to come into my life and save me from my sins, forgive me. And
how did that impact your marriage?
Well, it got a little smoother, I guess, and wasn't so concerned about that. But the reason why I appreciate these groups, this men's groups here, is because that's one of the reasons I came to know the Lord. Come to find out that this small group was praying for me, had been praying for me ever since I qualified for the tour, me and my wife. Mm. Second thing is this is where my spiritual growth began and continued for a long period of time in small groups. This is not a small group, but in groups like this. So it's amazing what fellowship and studying the Word will do. And
so you're a new believer. You're noticing, as we discuss, a a difference in the lives of some of these golfers. Golf fellowship. Larry is a new believer. You know, we're talking a whole lot about belonging, about community, and the role that we play with one another in encouraging and celebrating one another just to keep going in our relationship with Christ. So here is Larry experiencing success as a new believer. What does he do now in terms of growing? And so can you take a moment and share with us the influence those guys that made up Golf Fellowship and the interest they took in you, as you look back on your life, how pivotal that was for you in your relationship with Christ?
Yeah, these guys were praying. They saw something in me physically or game-wise that I didn't see in myself. They felt that they needed someone that could have an influence on the golfing community. Not that I'm a great person, but that accomplishments in some areas give you validity, give you the platform so that you can speak, so that you... I think God used a lot of that stuff. I remember down... Everything happens to me either on the road or the parking lot. So I'm just telling you that a lot of great things spiritually happens to you on the road or the parking lot, or bridges, one or the other. But I was down in a parking lot in Jacksonville, Florida, and I said, God, I don't know what you want from me. You probably don't need anything from me, but that I'm willing to do whatever you want me to do, whatever you want me to do. But don't send me to Africa. That was one of those caveats, and don't send me to Africa. But you can use me in any way you want to, but, yeah. So anyway, I think in that looking back in from the time that I became a Christian, they threw me right into, you need to go speak. You know, you need to go tell people about your new faith. And I remember in Pensacola, or in Pennsylvania, one of the guys that was leading, instrumental in starting the Bible study, asked me to go speak to this country club, just, you know, group in Pennsylvania. I said, sure. I said, sure, but I don't really want to. And he says, well, it'll be fine. You know, so there's a men's group kind of like this at the country club, and the guy that introduces me, and I'm supposed to be talking about the Lord, okay, my testimony and all that stuff. The guy that introduced me says, here's Larry Nelson. He wants to tell you about life on the tour. That was it. So from my seat up to the podium, all I could do is say, God says, you're going to have to do something here because I don't know what to do. Honestly, I went blank in a certain word. The guy said afterward, he said, that's the best I've ever heard. I don't remember anything I said. I don't remember, but it was pretty good. I understand it was pretty good. I'm just saying that, Scripture says, don't worry about what you're going to say. And I took that seriously when I walked up there. But since I became a believer, we ended up starting or improving the Bible study on the regular tour. I brought somebody out who was actually out there for 32 years and ministered to the players for 32 years. When I turned 50, the Bible study on the Champions Tour, five people maybe at the most, they was inconsistent on who was teaching and all that kind of stuff. And so I called Dean Bezaeus, who was head of the FCA golf ministry. I said, you need to pray with me so we can find someone to come out here. So Tom Randall was the person that ended up coming out, and we went from five people to Hawaii. We had 120 people that came to our study, and on the tour now, 120 people, players, wives, kids, and that kind of stuff. The change. We had more guys coming to the Bible study than didn't come to the Bible study, and so it was the talk of the tour basically at that time. So when people ask me, I ended up winning 19 times, actually 20 times if you count the the match play on the Champions Tour. And I can honestly tell them, when they asked me, what was the greatest thing, what was the biggest thrill that you ever had? I said, well, it was the increase in the number of people that came to the Bible study on Friday night. So, you know, everything changes when you become a believer. Everything is put in context of spirituality and not the physical. And I think that's the biggest thing that has changed since I came to know the Lord in 1975, is that, you know, our struggles are not necessarily, you know, against man. Our struggles are actually against the spiritual things of this world.
So what I'm hearing is that God Fellowship and those men that God brought into your life to disciple you, to encourage you, without that.
Two times on Sundays. Well, I went to church since I was 3 years old. We'd go two times on Sunday, Sunday morning, Sunday night. And I did that until I was 23 or 4. And a guy explained to me, he says, you know, going to church won't make you a Christian any more than standing out in your garage will make you a car, you know. And which is something I finally realized, is that just because I went to church did not mean that I was a Christian. Now, culturally, they would say, yeah, you're a Christian because you go to church. But individually, I was not. I went to revivals. I can't not tell you how many times that I went there and heard the message. I mean, the message was given, but somehow I didn't receive it. Not until I got into or out on the tour. And that's the reason small groups are so important, and that's the reason why there's a lot of growth in this group. Yeah. And so it's very important. And for me personally, that's what it's been. I've got one little story real quick. 1986, I was trying to figure out, I was just about to turn 40, and I was trying to figure out whether I wanted to continue to play on the tour or not. I mean, I'd hit the ball in the rough and I couldn't get it out of the rough. I said, well, is my career over? I had a really good and successful design business, and I didn't do the greens at Brookstone. Like I told you, I didn't do those. But I had a really successful design business, and so I was making a lot of money. I was traveling all over the world. I was doing golf courses and all that kind of stuff, and I just said, you know, is it time for me to leave the tour? And so I remember it just like it was yesterday. I went into my bedroom, got on my knees, and I prayed. I said, God, listen, I said, I don't know what to do. I do not know what to do. Should I leave the tour, follow this, or whatever? So anyway, after I prayed, it was not a voice. You know, I didn't hear a voice, but it was, Larry, I want you to play golf, but you got to work at it. Okay, I was tired of working at it. I mean, I've been at it for a long time, but he says, you're going to have to get better. So I decided at that point that I'd start working out. I'd start running and exercising and all that so I could hit the ball out of the rough, basically, is what it was. So I got in really good shape starting in 1986. So we go to Memphis the next year, 87. Heat index is 108. I mean, it's really hot in Memphis. This is August, 1st of August. So we played four rounds there. The next week is the PGA in West Palm. Heat index 112. I outlasted everybody. I ended up winning the tournament because I beat Lanny Watkins on the first playoff hole. Everybody else was tired. They were dead. So getting in shape in that 1 year from 86 to August of 87 gave me the PGA Championship. Now, with that PGA Championship, it got me in the Ryder Cup that year, gave me a 10-year exemption. Now, I'm almost 40, so I was exempt on the tour until 10 days before my 50th birthday, which I'd go on the Champions Tour. And so, you know, this was one of those things that, you know, if you asked of God, if you lack wisdom, you know, ask God. And this is one of those cases, just for me personally, where I did get the wisdom of God, and it turned out great. What happened on the Champions Tour was because of all that.
So, guys, what I'm hearing, and y'all know we kind of think this way as psychologists tell us. The way we think, we put everything in boxes so we compartmentalize. So I've got my career life, I've got my spiritual life, got my married life. You know, we got all these boxes. What I'm hearing from Larry is that God has a way of removing the boxes. And I know our careers, not professional sports necessarily, but we all have careers. So how is it that our spiritual life can play a pivotal role in the quality of our work, pursuing excellence, and through that to show the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Larry, if you would, and I know we've heard from you already, but to pinpoint that your spirit that you did, to make sure that your spiritual life was the driving force for your career on tour.
Well, I think it's really, we're given the command to disciple the world, basically. I mean, as a believer, it's not just a personal thing. It is a personal thing. But if you don't share it, you're just not doing what God wants you to do. And I know I don't have that personality, honestly. I took technical speaking in school. I lasted one class because I didn't want to get up in front of eight people and talk to them. So the biggest change in my life was being able to go speak. I mean, I spoke at a Billy Graham crusade, and there was a few people there, you know. Not only the people in the auditorium or whatever it was, but all the people watching it on television. And it goes back to the golf thing. If you get concerned about who's judging you or who's saying this or, you know, who's doing this, you're not going to be able to perform playing golf, and you're not going to be able to perform, not that you perform as a Christian, but that you are able to do, you know, what the most important thing is and then leave results up to God. That's kind of been the biggest thing with my career, my marriage, my raising my sons, and, you know, playing golf. It's one of those things that if I have people, and this is a blessing to me. Coming to speak to you this morning is a blessing to me. I enjoy this so much. But I have people, every place I go, every tournament I go to, says, do you remember speaking at Grand Rapids, Michigan, back in 1978 or whatever? No. I did so much speaking in a short period of time. I had people come up to me and say, boy, I really enjoyed what you had to say in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or something, Florida, or Canada. So it's one of those things that I felt a responsibility. Now, I'm not saying that everybody should have that responsibility. We don't all have a platform. I'm fortunate that I had a platform, but, you know, people's lives have been changed by coworkers. People's lives have been changed by doctors. People's lives have been changed just where you live. And this happened to be, the PGA Tour happened to be where I live.
Yeah.
And the opportunity, one guy on the tour came to know the Lord because I changed his tire. Now, he was a prim and proper guy, never changed a tire before. Apparently, he had not. I was raised in a small town where that's all we did was change our tire. So from ego, changing this guy's tire was no big deal. But he told the guys later, he says, the reason why I came to know the Lord is because I didn't know why Larry Nelson would change my tire.
Wow.
At the hotel. So I'm just saying, we don't realize sometimes what we do and what the effect will be. Sometimes we get to see what that is while we're still alive. But we can trust God in the fact that none of that goes out void.
Amen.
It always has a purpose, and it always has a reaction. And we're not supposed to hang around necessarily until the reaction is made. And so a lot of you men will see someone in heaven that you didn't realize was there because of you. Maybe because of what you said, because of what you did, because of, you know, just hanging out, just being a friend, just whatever. So we don't know what the impact is a lot of times until, and we won't know until we get to heaven.
Amen. All right, guys, is it safe to assume, excuse me, that every day at work is a little different? Stephen, is it? Graham?
Absolutely.
Every day is different. So his career didn't take place in an office or a business organization, but nonetheless, he went to work when he teed it up. Agreed?
I agree.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about a typical day, professional golf tournament. Brother, how in the world did you feel teeing it up on the first hole? How did you control your nerves?
Okay, and let me just tell you this story, all right? Like I said, I've known my wife forever, okay? And so this is my second year on tour. And I was fortunate enough to make the cut. I'm playing halfway decent. And my pairing the next day is Jack Nicklaus.
Oh, my
okay.
goodness.
Now, I had not met Jack, even though his locker, Nelson and Nicklaus, were pretty close. We were pretty close together. Had not really said, hi, Jack, how are you? You know, and none of that. Okay. So anyway, we were playing, and I'm sitting there having breakfast the morning before our round with my wife, Gail. And I said, you know, I'm playing with Jack today, you know. So today we get the chance to see who the greatest player in the world is.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah, there we go. So we go out and play, and I end up shooting 68 or something like that. He shot 69 or something. So I beat him.
Oh, my.
So anyway, as life goes on in the tour, about 6 months later, I'm paired with Jack again. And so Gail and I are having breakfast, and I said, you know, Gail, you know, Jack and I played, and I beat him. I shot 68, he shot 69. He says, today we really can see who the greatest player in the world is, right? If I beat him two times in a row. So we go out and play, and as things happen, he beat me. He shot a better score than I did. So I didn't, you know, I'm okay. I brush it off. I'm fine. About 4 months later, I get paired with Jack again. And so we're having breakfast again before I go out and play. And I says, you know, I'm playing with Jack today. I beat him once. He beat me once. Today is the day we find out who the greatest player in the world is. Yes. So she looked up at me and she said, Sugar, do you think Jack is thinking the same thing? So I'm just telling you that we talked about humility. God put Gail in my life to keep me humble. So she has done a great job, I hope, by the way. And I'll wear a badge. But every morning, yeah, it's kind of the way it is. But it's been every morning when you get up. There's a routine that you go through. Everybody has a little bit different routine. Always try to get to the golf course an hour or 45 minutes ahead. I never putt last. I always putt first because the last shot I hit, usually I'll hit with a driver. I'll hit, you know, four or five drivers, and then I hit 1 7-iron because I want to go from driver to an iron, and then I walk to the first tee and hit it, hopefully when I'm still loose and still warmed up. And always tell the boys, and this is something about your golf game you might want to realize, no matter what kind of shots I hit on the practice tee, I'll hit the cutest little fade out there, you know, just every time with a driver like this. But I know when I get on the first tee, I'm going to hit a pull. So I aim it down the right-hand side. That's just me. You just grip it differently, and you don't realize it. You grip it, you know, stronger or whatever. So we all have our things that we kind of habits or whatever. And so I know that. I tell the boys, we used to play in the father-son down in Orlando. And I told the boys, I said, okay, you see this shot here on the practice tee? I said, yeah, I'm going to aim it right down the right-hand side because I know I'm going to pull it off the first tee. So, you know, you kind of, they don't do that, though. I mean, they don't have that problem, apparently. But there's a lot of things that during the round, I think today in this modern game, I went to Sugarloaf, my last PGA Tour event that I played was at Sugarloaf. And I hadn't played in one in a year or two. And so I went up there and looked, and everybody, there were three people standing behind every pro. I was trying to figure out what in the world is going on here. They got the teacher, the psychologist, the physical trainer. They've got, they got all these guys. And then all of a sudden, they hit a bad shot somewhere on the golf course, and they lose it because they don't know how to fix it. We had to fix it ourselves. I mean, we didn't have a teacher that followed us around. We had to learn how, if we hit two or three hooks, we had to learn how, what's going on. And it's so funny. Trevino told me one time, he says, you know, I said, I'm not going to have anybody teaching me that hadn't won the U.S. Open. You know? I mean, that's... I mean, when you think about it, that's really pretty good. That's pretty good. I mean, how is somebody who hasn't won the U.S. Open going to tell me how to do it? So, but anyway, it's just that I've had lessons from, I got to tell you, one story. I'm playing down at Disney World. I hadn't played very good at all the second half of the year. I was just struggling. And I was hitting pulls, and I was, you know, it's just not very consistent. And I'm on the practice tee right before the first round, and this guy walks by, Ernie Vatterson, walks by, and I'd talked to him, you know, a few times or whatever, and he says, Larry, turn your left elbow out. Okay, if this is here, he told me to go here, turn my left elbow out towards the target. I made 23 birdies and an eagle in four rounds just from that one little tip.
Man.
So I ended up winning the tournament down at Disney that week. That's a fraction. You think about here to here. I mean, that's it. But I hit the ball so good. So that's just one of about 100 things that I go through if I'm not playing good. Is my elbow out? Am I doing this or I'm doing this? Every time I won the PGA in 81, thinking about my right leg. I won the U.S. Open in 83 by keeping my arms close together. That was all I was thinking about. In 87, when I won the PGA, I was thinking about my left leg.
Wow.
So there are things within the golf swing that you can focus on. You can't ever do more than one.
Yeah.
But you can do one at address, one during your swing, and you can think about that during your swing. Anything more than that, which probably a lot of you have that issue, you got about 10 thoughts in your brain, that it's really hard to actually be consistent about it.
So, guys, we're going to give you an opportunity in just a moment, two, three of you, to ask a question. Zach and TJ have mics, and if you'll raise your hand, then they'll come to you so Larry and I can hear. As they're getting ready for that, Larry, just real quick, what is the most interesting golf shot you ever hit?
Good or bad? Good or bad?
I mean, well,
I've had both, but I'll tell you about the bad one first. I'm playing at Augusta in 1984, and I was the U.S. Open champion. I won the U.S. Open in 83, and I'm playing at Augusta that next spring. And I'm tied with Ben Crenshaw after 11 holes on Sunday. So Ben and I are tied, going to the 12th hole. He was one group behind me. And I just birdied 11, which is the hardest hole in golf, I think, under those type of situations. I just made birdie there. And I was talking to myself from the time I went to left the green at number 11 until I got to the tee up at number 4. Now, there's scoreboards around, so everybody knew that I had just tied for the lead. And so the crowd was, boo, yeah, doing all that yelling or screaming. The patrons, not the crowd. Patrons were doing that. And so walking up to the 12th tee, I was trying to calm myself down. That never worked. I never got calmed down. But I felt infallible. Nothing could penetrate this, armor or whatever that I had going on. I was playing so good. So I'm trying to hit a cut 6-iron to the back right pin placement, And I hit it so fat. I hit so far behind it that I didn't know whether to tell the ball to get up or get down. It might get short of the water, and it's only 80 yards, I think, for the water. But anyway, I made double, ended up finishing fourth. But that shot has always stuck out
in
my mind, the bad one. The year before at the U.S. Open, I won the only U.S. Open that the regular 72 holes ended up on Monday, finishing on Monday. We had to stop because of rain, lightning, and whatever. Had to come out. I had to come back out on Monday morning, tied for the lead with Tom Watson, and start on 16. And he was starting on 15. He was a hole behind. I hit a 4-wood of 60 feet from the hole to take a one-shot lead. End up winning by one shot.
Wow.
So long putt, you don't know. But the greens were so good, and Oakmont's greens are usually pretty fast. By the time it got over the last little rise, I knew it was going to go in. So so good things happen and bad things happen. And, you got to kind of accept it, for what it is. But you can always look back and say, gee, if I'd have done this or gee, if I'd done that. If I had a good caddy at Augusta, I probably would have won. Because he would have told me to hit it in the middle of the green, hit it over the bunker, putt, and go to the next hole. But I didn't have one, and he said, yeah, go for it, man. So, so anyway.
All right, who's got a question?
Question.
Tom, back there.
Can you hear me?
I can. Where would it be and why?
Yeah, what course? Only one more round of golf.
I thought about that because it may be that way pretty quick. So I've had a lot of thoughts about that. It actually probably would be Cypress Point in Monterey. It's like three different golf courses in one. And the finish, although the 18th hole is not very good, the 15, 16, 17 is one of the prettiest three holes I've ever seen, where they are and all that. And so that would probably be it.
Kevin Knox is taking me there next year.
Is he?
No, but Kevin, there's...
Well, it's a good
now
thing to think
to.
About.
Now he has to. You're obligated.
That's right.
Yes, Bill.
Are they still having the Bible studies on the tour?
Ah, good question.
Both tours are still having them. Not the same leaders, but they're both still very active. Zach Johnson and a lot of those guys are still going they changed it. It changes around from Tuesday night to Thursday night or Friday night, but they usually have it. I don't know how many people they're having at each meeting, but it's still ongoing. What's great right now, there's a college golf fellowship, which is really a platform. They reach a lot of college golfers for the Lord, and then they just transition the ones that do make it into the regular tour. And the web got dot, it's not web, what it corns? Oh, I don't know what. The other tour, they have a Bible study there. They have one on the ladies tour. So there's a Bible study everywhere, fellowship, all the tours.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Guys, let's give Larry a hand. Can we do that?
Well, thanks. Appreciate it. Yeah. But don't forsake getting together, okay? Because it's really important. The fellowship is hugely important. And just remember, this is where God wants you and wants you to be able to share your walk.
Amen. Zach, come up, close us out, brother.
Oh, as Larry's walking off, is there any truth
takes
to the
me a little while to walk.
Is there any truth to the story that Lee Trevino at one point took a one iron in the middle of a thunderstorm, put it over his head, and people asked him why?
But the sad thing about it is he actually
hit a one iron. Is that true?
That's probably pretty much the case. But the sad thing about it is he actually got struck by lightning up in Chicago. So
don't tempt God, right?
You don't want to go there. No, you don't. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.